Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
We had pasta cookers in our facilities that were, think of a like a regular pasta pot, but ours were 10-foot diameter. And we had baskets on a crane we would lower down in there. So we would load all the pasta. We had a trolley with a crane.
Shane, appreciate you taking the time to hop on and chat with me today. And one of the first things that I always got to ask and start things off with is, how did you fall into food?
Oh, man. You know, it was kind of almost on accident, really. You know, when I was a real young guy, teenager, 15, 16, all my buddies were cutting lawns and doing all that sort of thing. And I didn't really like working that hard. So, of course, I went and took a restaurant job. You know, I think I was 15 years old and took my first job was at a Longhorn Steakhouse. And it was so long ago, my primary job was sweeping up peanut hulls off the floor. Cause remember way back then they used to throw the peanuts on the floor. So I kind of got in the restaurant thing after school and I was doing a little bit of everything, front of the house stuff. They had me doing prep work and I kind of learned, a little bit about the restaurant business. Doing that, so much so that when I was 17, I was offered to go and open up a store down in Destin, Florida, at the beach, and was supposed to be gone for a month, and wound up staying down there for 10 years, and you know, worked with them for a long time. Got to be up into management with them, and when they went corporate, of course, I decided I didn't want to stick around for that, so I was kind of at a time when I was 25 and wondering what I was going to do with my life, and decided I was out of the restaurant business and out of food forever and going to figure out what I was going to do. So I came to visit my father and was going to stay with him for a couple days and then go out west, and Hurricane Katrina hit. So I could not travel because there was no gas. And so it was kind of one of those things where I met some friends of my father's while I was staying around, and they said, "Hey, you know a lot about food from being in the restaurant business. We just bought a brand, a frozen meal brand, and we don't know anything about prepared food. Would you go consult with us for a couple of weeks and go check out our co-packer?" And I was like, "Yeah, great. What's a co-packer?" You know, I had no idea about the industrial food side. So I wound up taking a position with them, going up to their co-packer. Was supposed to stay for a couple of weeks, stayed there for 18 months, and then came back to Georgia and helped them build a plant. So I learned pretty much everything there was about industrial large-scale meal production, and we built out our first plant in Athens, Georgia in 2009, and ran that business for I went from being a consultant, like a low-paid young hourly guy, to being the general manager of a company called Golden Cuisine. And, you know, we were selling about $20 million worth of senior meals a year. So I was in charge of all those operations for a number of years. You know, we made 80 different SKUs of medically tailored meals before they were even called that. And so I wound up running that operation for quite a long time. The original owner sold it for a lot of money, and I went with the new owners and built another plant in South Georgia and continued on my role as GM for them for a period of time. And I really love being in the plant, love working with the people. I love, you know, all the food making technology, but unfortunately I had some really serious health issues and had to leave that position. You know, it was one of those things where, you know, whenever you have a really solid plan, sometimes things intervene. And I was kind of forced to leave being in the plant all the time. But the good news is I kind of became a subject matter expert on prepared meals. So when I was trying to decide what I was going to do next, the people that I'd been working with packaging and with equipment and that sort of thing, said, hey, you know, we know you don't want to work 15-hour days anymore in a plant. Come and work with us. And so I've been doing packaging and equipment ever since. In addition to some other things, I have a company called Dharma Food Group that I own, and we do product development, project management, and launch support and those sort of things for brands. And I still make medically tailored meals. We can kind of go into how that came kind of full circle. But now, instead of running the plant myself, I utilize a network of co-packers to make that product for me. And I'm still in packaging and equipment, just with some other folks. So, you know, it's a...
Yeah, we're going to get a nerd out a little bit on packaging and MAP, you know, modified atmospheric packaging. People are going to be like, wait, what? Where are we going with this? Because I had some exposure to it about 3-4 years ago, and now I've really delved into it more and more. It's just very interesting and fascinating, and how much it's part of our everyday life, and people just don't understand that it's everywhere. If you really pay attention, you're like, oh, there's something that's had modified atmospheric packaging, or they've done some sort of manipulation to the product. But I first want to ask, what was the learning curve, you know, going from, you know, again, you're in the food, but learning the industry side of things? You know, now there's a lot more resources. You can go online, you know, with AI, everything else. Yep. But how was it then to actually learn the process? Was it the old school way of just being in the factory?
It was the old school way of, you know, putting on a smock and a hairnet and some rubber boots. And when I first went in to check out their co-packer, it was kind of a tense relationship. You know, they were having quality issues and that sort of thing. And they said, hey, go up there and fix it. But I didn't know how to tell them how to fix it because I was kind of green. So what I had to wind up doing was I went in and worked side by side with every position in the plant. I cooked on the kettles. I would do that for a week. I would work with the folks scaling for a week. And I wanted to understand how every bit of it worked, because when you're in a food plant, it looks like chaos, right? You got this going over here and this going over here, but it's organized chaos. And I wanted to understand how all of that worked. So I went and, you know, worked with every position in the place, worked with you know, their chefs, worked with their QA people. And eventually, I got really interested in the QA side of things. And that was when kind of early on, when you could get certificates online, you know, it was kind of in its infancy. So I went ahead and got HACCP certified. I went ahead and, you know, got all of that sort of thing, done, mainly because I was stuck in a faraway place and had nothing to do on the weekends. But, you know, I wanted to know how it worked because I was very interested in it. And I'm kind of a process nerd. I want to know how things work. And I'm kind of a mechanical guy. So I was like, wow, how does this boiler work? How does this generate steam to heat up the kettle to, you know, to cook the sauce? And so I've always been interested in food, but I got more interested in the technology side of how you take something that you would make in your kitchen at home and make, you know, 300 gallons at a time, you know. And at the time, you know, we were making between 22 and 26,000 meals a day. And so there was some scale there. So, you know, I wanted to learn how to do all of it, you know, how to grind the meat, how to make the meatloaf, you know. And so I soaked all that up enough to where I was really confident when we went to build out our own plant. You know, here's kind of how we start from the beginning. And so it took a lot of backbreaking work.
Yeah, I was going to say, paint a picture. I don't think people understand how big these facilities are and like the volume that's being cooked. But maybe, I don't know, try and paint a picture of kind of what that looks like. People hear steam kettles and they hear these boilers. I've been lucky enough to be in a facility, so I know what it is. But maybe just paint a broad stroke picture of kind of what these facilities look like.
Yeah, you know, we did things a little bit differently. We used cryogenic freezing, using nitrogen to actually freeze. So you didn't have to have as big of a footprint because we would actually go from cooking the food and taking it out hot to plating it hot to it being frozen in about 7 minutes using liquid nitrogen. So, you know, if you imagine, you know, take your average restaurant kitchen, and if you think about the scale of things, your average stock pot in a restaurant kitchen is, you know, 10 or 12 quarts, right? Multiply that by, you know, going up to, say, 300 gallons was our kettle size. the kettles were actually served by mezzanines. So you had to go up the stairs because the kettle, I mean, think about how big it is. It's up on a stand. You know, they were 10 to 12 feet tall. So we had to climb up on mezzanines and actually stand up there. And you know, I've got some photos of that stuff from back in the day, but these cooking vessels are massive, you know. So, you know, we would run 1,600 pounds. If we were making marinara sauce, we would take 50-gallon drums of tomato paste and use a drum unloader, which basically squeezes a 50-gallon drum and shoots tomato paste up in there. Same thing with, you know, diced tomatoes with, and we would scale spices in 5-gallon buckets. You know, when you're at home making, you know, making pasta sauce, you got a little bit of oregano. Well, we would weigh it and then carry it upstairs and dump it in a 5-gallon bucket. So, you know, it's the same process that you do at home. It's just on a much, much larger scale. You know, when we would buy, you know, diced tomatoes, they come in the big white IBC containers like you see people store water in, you know, those 220-gallon containers. So when you're talking about that much scale, it's similar to what you do in a restaurant or home. It's just so much larger. You know, when we had pasta cookers in our facilities that were, think of like a regular pasta pot, but ours were 10-foot diameter, and we had baskets on a crane we would lower down in there. So we would load all the pasta. We had a trolley with a crane. You have a, you know, lower it down, you know, it cooks for 8 minutes and you pull it back up and hose it off with a hose to shock it. So, you know, food is food, but when you're doing it on such a large scale, you know, you just have to have cooler toys, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that was very fascinating to me to walk in and, you know, and see, okay, here we go from ingredient to cooking, to plating, to sealing, to freezing, and then with it being senior meals, what I did, most everything was in a bundle pack, meaning we would put the meals up in the freezer and then come out and make a menu of 7 meals with other items because everything was home delivered to senior citizens. So there was even more complication in that business. And I'm still doing that today just for other groups. You know, if you have medical insurance and you're discharged for, say, a heart condition, you'll get 21 meals or 28 meals. And I develop the meals and have them made where they will ship them to your home. It's different now than it used to be. They used to bring them on vans, but now it comes in FedEx. But, you know, still involved in that type of nutrition. And, you know, still doing a pretty good amount of those meals, but that's kind of turned into a side business, more of a passion project than anything else, just because I enjoy it, you know, and I still do all the culinary R&D as well. I do all that myself.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about MAP, what it is. Again, we're going to go down probably the HACCP rabbit hole, that the dirty letters that every restaurateur is like, ugh, HACCP, yeah. I hate it. But maybe talk about what HACCP is to a small degree, right, for anyone that doesn't know, and then touch on MAP and how it really has affected the food system.
Yeah, and, you know, I've been now 20 years dealing with modified atmosphere packaging from a product standpoint, and now I actually sell the equipment and do the consulting for people to do modified atmosphere packaging. Basically, what modified atmosphere packaging is you are taking that tray of food that you get at Kroger or Jewel Osco. I mean, everybody's seen the black tray of food, right? What you're doing with modified atmosphere is you're controlling the atmosphere inside of that tray in order to mitigate microbial growth, meaning what typically what happens is with modified atmosphere, you have an environment in that tray of oxygen, right? You know, if you have a tray in your kitchen, it's filling with the oxygen that's in the air. What modified atmosphere does is it removes that oxygen, replaces it with another inert gas, which is typically nitrogen, CO2, and then that plastic film goes on top and seals in that nitrogen and CO2 inside that tray in order to keep the food fresher for longer. The technology has been around about 60 years, but it's really been perfected in the last, probably the last 15 years. And in refrigerated meals, it is in every refrigerated meal that's out there, whether your listeners know it or not. You know, if you go buy a queso dip, or if you go buy guacamole or hummus or any prepared meal that's refrigerated, that modified atmosphere is key to making it last. If you just put the film seal on there, it might stay fresh for 5 or 6 days. If you use modified atmosphere, it can stay fresh for up to 30, depending on the product and how you do it. And there are some other technologies there that a lot of people are starting to see more, like vacuum skin pack. I don't know if you've seen that, where the film is actually sucked down to the product.
Yeah, I just started seeing that, and I was like, seeing it more. It wasn't as common. I think it's starting to come out more, but yeah, maybe, I guess, for people to understand, like, imagine like a piece of salmon on a plate, and then basically the plastic forms around it. So there's no, it doesn't have to be in a tray per se, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's basically what it is. But how does that work then with the gas flush and food safety? How does that all work?
Well, there's the vacuum skin pack is a little bit different technology. With the whole idea is to remove oxygen, because microbes thrive in an oxygen rich environment. With MAP, what you're doing is you're displacing the oxygen and putting in other gases, so those microbes don't have anything to feed on. With VSP, what you're doing is removing the entire atmosphere from the entire thing. So you're removing all the oxygen just by basically, you know, sucking the film down to there and having no oxygen in the product. So that pulls a vacuum basically on the entire product. And like, if you've got, you know, macaroni, it pulls all the oxygen out of everything and puts a seal to it. So with VSP on different products, you can go a pretty long time. And some of the other benefits to that, and I can share with you some videos and whatnot if you want to put in there with editing, is you can also apply product to, you mentioned not necessarily a tray, but even like a board. You can have a piece of paper and put the product right on there. Steaks, you know, seafood, there's a lot of that goes on vacuum skin packaging, and it really protects the food. And you can even display it upright. And I've got some examples in the other room I can grab if your listeners can, you know, kind of want to see what that looks like. But it's a really neat technology, and I'm becoming more and more of an expert in it. And I'm working on helping manufacturers to figure out how to do VSP more effectively and MAP as well with the technology that I'm selling.
So what would be the advantage of VSP over, say, traditional MAP packaging? Or why would somebody say, okay, I want that VSP moving forward?
Well, there a couple of things. If you're going to display a product where the product is actually facing out, if you go into your retailer, whether it's an HEB or Publix or whatnot, if you go in the grab-and-go section, you can actually billboard the product to where you can see the product. If you did that in a regular tray, all the product would fall, right? VSP holds it in place. You know, one of the other benefits too is when you put it in the microwave, it can actually steam, and the steam from the product will actually balloon up the film itself. So it helps it retain more moisture and helps it cook more evenly. And for a lot of the folks like your meal prep guys that are shipping meals to the home, it protects the meals a lot more, and it doesn't move around and shift in transit. So, you know, there are some drawbacks to VSP. It's a little slower to produce, because you've got to preheat the film, you've got to vacuum it. You know, it's a little bit slower. The films are more expensive, but there are, you know, some definite use case scenarios for it where it makes a lot of sense, especially in things like seafood, where, you know, you take a salmon steak, and if you were able to put it on a board or on a aluminum tray and take all the atmosphere out of it, it will keep it fresher for a lot longer.
Yeah. Fresh food, right? That's what the name of the game and nowadays and mass production. I mean, we have to have this in order to feed, you know, basically everyone around the world.
Well, and you know, if you utilize packaging technologies, you can eliminate a lot of preservatives and things that you don't want in your foods. You know, if you don't have an environment where mold can thrive, if you have a nitrogen rich environment, you don't have to put mold inhibitors into your product. You know, you don't have to put all these preservatives and all this stuff that is, has been proven that it's not good for you. You know, where nitrogen is inert, you know, it's not going to hurt you. It's not going to do anything detrimental to you. So you can have the food as close to, you know, being from the farm as possible without all the extra processing. So, you know, if you utilize, you know, certain technologies, to preserve food, you know, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to have all the bad stuff in there. And I think we've gone down a road, you know, as Americans in the last 50, 60 years of just putting all this junk into food. And we're finally starting to wake up and realize that you don't have to have it in there. You know, if you utilize freezing or with refrigerated, if you utilize a modified atmosphere, you can take all that crap out of the food that's going to wind up in your body. So it's really exciting.
You mentioned farmers. Are you working with farmers now more? Or are they the big guys? Are they looking at this technology to incorporate into their operations, or are they still kind of taking it down the supply chain and still selling off the raw goods to, you know, a secondary?
You know, there's been a big push in the entire industry to go more fresh and to work with agriculture producers of the last few years. You know, you see a lot of a shift in the ag community and to do a more fresh things. And you've also seen a lot of hydroponic operations being grown, and people are getting more health conscious. And so I think that now the shift is even in prepared meals, it has gone to be more, you know, more farm to table. And I think that's a good thing. You know, we're homestead people. We grow all of our own vegetables and do all of our own things here at my house. And that's important. You probably hear a rooster or a peacock in the background on the noise there. But, you know, I think our food system, if you utilize smart technology, does not have to have, you know, we don't have to bring broccoli from China. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to do all of, you know, these things as cost cutting measures that, you know, that we used to. So that, you know, I think that we're going to see healthier food in the next few years because the consumers demand it. And finally, the government is starting to get behind it a little bit. And, you know, and I think that we can do better food with smarter agriculture, with, you know, with new technology in agriculture and new technology in how we process our food. And so I think it's a really a renaissance in what we're going to see in the next 10 years in our entire food system.
Yeah, I think it'll be really exciting to see some of the vertical farming really take off. I know up here in Chicago, there's I think it's Mighty Vine Tomatoes. It is. That they do, I think, some indoor agriculture, and it's really cool because you can get these awesome little cherry tomatoes year round.
Yeah.
You know, and they taste phenomenal. My kids love them, and they're just better than, you know, having to go canned or something that's, like you said, modified or picked so early in its growing season that you're not getting that flavor that you would expect from fresh quality food.
And there's been a lot of, you know, folks like you mentioned, people like Gotham Greens and Bright Farms and some of these other, you know, folks that are doing more indoor agriculture and are doing, you know, hydroponics and having other technologies. And, you know, even, you know, regular, you know, traditional agriculture is going, you know, is going smarter. I mean, you know, I live in middle Georgia. You know, we're, you know, soybean and peanut country here. And, you know, the yields are getting better on those crops without having to use, you know, all the GMOs, and they're smarter with how they apply pesticides, smarter with how they do, you know, the entire growth system. You know, I mean, we've really come a long way, whether people realize it or not. You know, a lot of people don't think about, you know, about farms as being how you get fed. You know, people think you get lettuce from the grocery store, right? But there's a lot of things in the background that are really, you know, impacting our systems. And, you know, there's been a bigger focus on more local and more regenerative agriculture too. And we're seeing that a lot. I'm a member of the Georgia Department of Agriculture's Georgia Grown program. And we have symposiums every year where, you know, we talk about how smart agriculture is really going to impact our food system. And it's been, you know, kind of a rebirth in how we do that the last few years. It's been good to see, and I think it's going to continue.
Yeah. What are some of those things those farmers are doing? Things that you guys talk about for the future? What are people doing to be more sustainable, to be turn maybe some of these standard practices to more regenerative?
You know, I think they're, we're almost going backwards in a way to where they're looking at regenerative agriculture like we did in, you know, the 18th century, right? You know, you rotate out, okay, I'm going to graze chickens here today, and then I'm going to move them to another pasture, and I'm going to graze pigs here, and here's why, and then I'm going to plant a cover crop. And you, and instead of trying to control nature through the magic of modern chemistry, which we've been doing, you know, we did the entire 20th century. We sprayed DDT and we did all this stuff. You know, you're finding out that you can do it organically and do it sustainably, but also do it at scale. You know, because you're not, you know, just completely destroying the land and having to, you know, refertilize it. Because if you are, you know, if you're rotating out how you do things and how you graze animals and how you grow crops on that same piece of land, you know, you can really take a, you know, a more of a compact farm and put out more pounds of protein and more pounds of vegetables, you know, just by utilizing techniques that were forgotten a long time ago. You know, there's a, I don't know if you've ever read Joel Salatin's stuff or seen any of his things about regenerative agriculture. I recommend you look that up. He's got a, there was a documentary about his farm up in Virginia that came out a couple months ago. He's doing really great things. White Oak Pastures here in Georgia, there's a guy named Will and Jenny Harris down there. They have a fantastic integrated regenerative farm where now they're doing their own beef processing on site and those sort of things. And it just really helps our food system. And I think, you know, food preservation technology can also help with that too, right? You know, if you're making, you know, organic meat that doesn't have all the ick in it, but you can pack it and make it to where you can, you know, slaughter that, that animal and process it here in Georgia and be able to ship it to you in Chicago. And it still have, you know, 25 days of shelf life on it. You know, those things all play in together in order to make it a, you know, more sustainable, food system. And it's good to see.
Yeah, I love it. I work with a farm down in southern Indiana. They do the same thing, regenerative farm. The processing plan is literally attached to basically the logistics side. Literally, there's a little hallway that they connect.
Yep.
And it literally is brought in from the farm down the street, gets slaughtered, you know, same day, and then ready to go, you know, and then they use vacuum sealing technology. And you've got an easy 30 days with the solid vacuum. Yep. And they're not using going crazy on the technology, but you're getting a high quality peak product that animal's not stressed. You can just taste the difference. The animal lived a happy, healthy life. And when you eat it, you just feel more fulfilled. You don't feel like you need to eat, you know, half a pound or three quarters of a pound. You can eat a good quarter pound. You're like, I feel good. Especially when you add, you know, some fresh vegetables or fresh fruit to that meal, it doesn't take a whole lot. And then now all of a sudden you start to change your biochemistry. And then you don't need as much food, which then impacts the whole cycle of the food process, right? Now we're not intaking these massive meals that are half a pound to a pound of food. And we're getting back to, I believe, what we should be. And I think, like you said, it's moving back in time where we eat what was appropriate for our bodies.
Yeah. And, you know, here at our home, we grow all of our own vegetables. I don't know if you can see the garden out the back window there, but, you know, we've got a pretty massive garden. And if you take a heirloom tomato, you know, like a Cherokee purple or something like that, and you cut into that and you cut into a Walmart tomato, it's almost like they're not the same species of plant. You know, I mean, I'm so used to, especially here in the summertime, you know, we eat tomato sandwiches and just, you know, we got more tomatoes we know to do with. We're giving them away up and down the road. But I was somewhere traveling the other day and got a sandwich with a tomato on it. I was like, ick, you know, it's not even the same in the same class. And, you know, I think with using high technology, but also using heritage practices in how we produce the food, you know, we can do better. You know, we can really, you know, kind of carry the whole food system forward where you're going to make healthier individuals, because we've really backslid, you know, on that for years and years. I mean, you know, especially kids nowadays just, you know, eat too much junk. And I think that, And we did when I was a kid too. I mean, I grew up on Little Debbie snack cakes, but you know, maybe we can find a better way forward. And that's kind of the hope with, you know, technology and food processing.
Well, it's a happy medium, right? I think there, you can have some gluttonous and some enjoyment in your life you know, those products. But as long as you balance it out, I believe personally that you can still live a good life and have a nutritious diet when you just don't, again, indulge in those things every day, all the time. And I have found personally, when I don't consume those things that, with the highly addictive additives, that I don't want them. I'm not craving sweets all the time. I'm really in, like, I want a piece of fruit. I don't know why. I just, if it's going to fill me up. I've gotten really into dried fruit as of late. I do a lot of dried fruit bars, and it's just like, that's my dessert. I don't need ice cream. I don't need snack cakes. I don't need candy. Give me a couple dried fruit bars and I've got my sweet tooth fixed, and it's also helping kind of round out and fill up myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's how you think about things, you know, those sweets and those sort of things. I mean, it's a dopamine hit, right? I mean, you know, it's just like it's just like taking drugs or alcohol or something for some people. But you know, you can shift the way you think about food and what you're used to and get the same enjoyment out of a apricot that you can out of a, you know, a Nutty Buddy bar. It's just all in how you think about it.
Yeah, for sure. Let's shift gears. I want to talk a little bit about why you started the Dharma Group, what Dharma, you know, Dharma is, and why you started it.
Yeah, you know, the name, everybody's like, what does that mean? You know, the concept of Dharma is kind of an Eastern religion sort of thing. It basically boils down to, in Hinduism and Buddhism, what you're meant to do and what you're supposed to do. You know, if you were born to be a farmer, that is your Dharma. That is your calling, right? You know, what I felt when I started that was, you know, it was my calling to help provide good food for necessary needs, right? You know, essentially what we do is I do a couple of projects with, like, you know, waffles and some other stuff, but the core of what I do at Dharma Food Group is food for people that need it and medically tailored food. So generally, most of what I'm doing now are medically tailored meals for diabetes, for renal failure, for heart conditions. And I've got a whole network. I think we're up to 92 SKUs now of prepared meals that we develop menus that target specific ailments and for post-acute discharge. So what I do is I work with agencies and private label these meals for them. So you won't be able to go anywhere and see a Dharma Food Group meal. So I will work with, you know, if it's XYZ insurance company, we'll make the XYZ insurance company meals, but we will make them specifically tailored to a particular need. So, you know, we do pureed meals for people with dysphagia that they can't swallow. We do a lot of mechanically soft meals for people that have difficulty chewing. You know, a lot of those type of meals, you know, I develop all that myself. I do a lot of the nutritional work myself. I nerd out on software to do that. I also employ a dietitian that does a lot of that sort of thing. So essentially, you know, I will, you know, come up with all these meals that will work for, you know, for different ailments. We'll sell them to these agencies. They send me an order and I work with a couple of co-packers to make the product. So, you know, I really enjoy that kind of work. You know, we were really, really busy during COVID, incredibly busy during COVID. And it's slowed down a little bit now because, you know, some of the funding isn't there like it was. But, you know, we're still doing, you know, 150,000 meals a month, you know, which is a good number. And we're feeding a lot of people in, you know, across the country. You know, went involved in different programs, and I also am doing child nutrition programs with that. So I've taken some of the meals that were appropriate for seniors and kind of made them more kid centric, but they're still healthy meals that will meet the National School Breakfast Program and National School Lunch Program requirements. And so we're doing frozen meals for districts that will do send home meals for in the summertime, or in certain districts where you've got a high percentage of children that are on free lunch, they will send home a frozen meal with that child because they may not have nutritional support at home. So, you know, I and working with that, you know, that kind of a market. Luckily, you know, I'm surrounded by a lot of really good people, and we've been doing it so long that the framework is kind of laid for that. So it doesn't take up all my time. So, you know, so I do the packaging equipment, like we talked about, also, run a 501c3, Christian food ministry. You know, where if I have surplus, goods that I can come up with where somebody says, hey, you know, we've got 3,000 pounds of this product that we've discontinued, I'll work on getting that to agencies in need and churches in need. And, you know, just really want to be able to, you know, to work to make sure that the most vulnerable people, you know, our seniors and our kids have access to good nutrition, because, you know, a lot of times they don't.
Yeah, no, I love it. I got a lot of questions popping in my head. What does the R&D process look like when you're developing these meals, especially with all the specialty diets? What's kind of, you know, you have something brand new, XYZ client says, we need these type of meals. Like, kind of walk through, what does that R&D process actually look like?
You know, what I typically do is I think about who the end user is going to be, right? So if, you know, if an agency, like say I had, you know, I'll just make up a Meals and Wheels of Seattle, right? If they called me and said, you know, hey, we want some meals for our senior population, I will look, and number one, I'll ask them some demographics about who they're feeding, right? Because people in Seattle are going to eat different meals than people in Alabama, for instance. You know, something, you know, if I sent biscuits and gravy to Seattle, they're going to be like, what is this, right? So we'll look at the demographics, look at the age. I'll look at some of the local cuisine, and I'll go to the internet and just say, okay, what was some of the more popular dishes in the 1970s in the Pacific Northwest? Because you got to think, you know, people eat with their memory, right? We always want comfort food, which is what we had when we were kids. And if it turns out that, you know, one of the greatest, you know, dishes was, you know, ham and pineapple fried rice, so, you know, I'm just making something up, I will start with that. And then, you know, we'll take, and I'll just make some notes. Okay, here are some flavors that I think are going to work, that people are going to enjoy. You know, and then I basically, you know, go to the kitchen and say, okay, you know, we want to make this sauce. I'll look around online and find a couple of, you know, sketches of kind of what that could be. And then just go to the kitchen and, you know, and start playing around with it until I find something that's going to be nutritionally adequate, but also taste good. And sometimes I'll go and, you know, bam, you know, it's great. You know, it's first time, that's awesome. Sometimes I'll work on it for a month. You know, it's just like anytime you're developing a recipe. And I do that kind of client specific. You know, I do a lot of work down in Miami, so I had to, you know, so we're doing picadillo, and you know, and we're doing, you know, we're doing arroz con pollo and all this, you know, Cuban style stuff, and, you know, putting plantains in senior meals, which I thought would never happen. But, you know, we want to be able to have meals that people enjoy. So, you know, that's kind of the R&D process, is I'll start with, okay, who's getting it? And then, you know, what would they like? And then, you know, luckily I've been doing this, you know, 20 years now. So, sometimes the R&D process is I just look back at my file and what I did in, you know, 2012, I've got a formula for. But, you know, if I've got to start from scratch, I just go in the kitchen, put on my headphones, turn on some tunes, and start cooking, you know, write everything down, you know, and until I've got it to where I want it. And then I will take put everything in my software. I use NutriCoster. I've got a huge database in NutriCoster, and it'll say, okay, well, here's all the ingredients, here's the process, you know, here's the nutritional. Does it work? Most of the time, yes, because I've been doing it a long time. Sometimes it doesn't. I got to scrap it and go back to the drawing board. So, but once I've got a single meal done, generally everything I do is in a 7-pack. So I'll develop an entire menu. You know, generally for a particular client, I'll usually do about 28 meals. So it won't be a, you know, they're not eating the same thing over and over. Right. You know, that'll give them 4 weeks to have any repeats, and, you know, just go to the kitchen, develop it, and then work with the co-packer to launch it. You know, luckily I work with some really good packers where if I take a recipe, I've got a template that I put it in where it automatically can scale. You know, I put in what my original batch was in grams, and then I can scale it to 50 pounds or 5,000 pounds or however we want it. And I'd utilize percentages to do that. So there's a lot of nerd math involved in the recipe part, but generally, you turn that recipe into a math equation, you do everything with weight. So, you know, and so I just figure out, you know, it's got 0.17% salt. It's got 2.24% mm-hmm. oregano and that's how we scale it. And so we very seldom, when we're doing a launch, have any kind of an issue or mishap. You know, once it's in black and white, you've got a good spec, you just go to market with it.
Yeah. Two tips for people at home. Mm-hmm. Weigh your ingredients. It's so much more accurate Always. And 10 times easier to do a recipe. And two, use the metric system. I fought the metric system for so long, and just recently I've been doing some R&D and I was like, I can't do this. I cannot keep converting everything in ounces to pounds. It just became a logistical nightmare. Switched over to the metric yep. and I'm like, why have I never been using the metric system my entire life? I just fought it and fought it. It's mind changing.
Oh yeah, brother. If you can count to 10, you can do the metric system. You know, I mean, that's, and it really helps, it helps you, especially when you're doing small things. If you're doing an R&D batch, you know, you might have, you know, 3/4 of a gram of, you know, turmeric and something. And, yep. You know, I mean, if I ever got pulled over, they'd probably think I was dealing drugs. I got a bunch of scales and, you know, and stuff in the back yep. of my, in the back of my car. But, you know, I mean, that's just the kind of doing an R&D, you know, you turn that recipe into a math equation and you can scale it up or scale it down. And, you know, so we've, you know, I feel like have done a good job understanding that market and making meals for it. You know, of course I'd love to sell more meals, but you know, it'll come when it comes. You know, I feel blessed that we're doing what we're doing.
I think once people can get out of their head, if they can find the right people in the industry to do the meals, because there's such a misconception of it's a frozen meal, so it must taste like mm-hmm. dog shit, right? Yeah. Like that's just the conception is I see a frozen tray, it's got to taste like crap, which it doesn't have to taste like yeah. crap. If you have the right ingredients, fresh ingredients, you know, people don't understand that a lot of your vegetables have the most nutrients when they're blast frozen or fresh mm-hmm. from pick, because you're locking in that, but they just think, it's a frozen vegetable, so it must taste like crap. And they think that it has to be pulled straight out of the garden and into their mouth for it to taste good. And I don't think that's the case, especially like we've talked about with the technology, mm-hmm. with being able to change the atmosphere, locking it in, quick freezing. There's so many things that we can do rather than putting in preservatives, which we've done for so long to prolong that food life, that if people could get it out of their head, then they would maybe look at it a little different of, oh my God, this is going to taste like crap.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that I do in all of our meals is I don't process any of the vegetables. They go in there basically individually quick frozen and raw. Into there. So the first time that it's really cooked is when it's microwaved or when it's popped in the oven. So you know, you maintain the texture, you maintain the moisture, you know, there's not a, you know, you can't sell these meals for $10 or $12 a piece. You know, I mean, they're inexpensive meals. So, you know, we've got to, you know, stay within that framework, but I mean, you know, you can get good, nutritious, good tasting meals and, you know, by utilizing smart packaging technology, smart processing technology, you can do a great meal for not a whole lot of money and, you know, and be able to provide nutritional support. You know, you just have to, but you know, it's funny whenever I have even had a couple of agencies try our meals and say, hey, these are too good. You know, we're used to getting this chopped and formed chicken. And with all of our meals, we take chicken trim when they cut the Chick-fil-A chicken piece out, all the leftovers, we cook it in a kettle. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's all white meat, you know, pulled chicken. And some folks are like, how do you do this and do it, you know, cost effectively? I'm like, well, it took a lot of learning, but we do. And, you know, and the packaging, you know, helps preserve it to get it to the, to get it to the end user, whether we're doing it refrigerated or frozen, because we do some of both.
Right. 100%. I absolutely love it. I think it's just, that's why I have these conversations, to educate the general public mm-hmm. about what's available, because I don't, again, people just don't know what's out there because they've never had the exposure or there's just no one talking about it. It's always kind of in the background. If somebody does it and they learn somehow yeah. and they put it together. But you know, what you do is truly special. You know, how do people find you? How do they find your organization? I think that's incredible what you do with mm-hmm. taking food and getting it out. Where do people go?
DharmaFoodGroup.com is my website. You know, you can contact me through there, or ChristianFoodMinistry.com. I haven't done a whole lot with it just because I've been working on starting a nonprofit is a lot of red tape. So I finally got that up and going and starting to work with some agencies there. But also, you know, people in the industry, you know, one of the main reasons that I wanted to talk to is, in addition to my work with Dharma Food Group, you know, I also am a representative for ILPRA out of Italy that manufactures packaging machines to do all this modified atmosphere and vacuum skin pack. So, you know, you can contact me via my Dharma Food Group website if you want to know about the packaging equipment. I can get back with you. But I've worked with Roberts Technology Group out of Philadelphia where we represent all that equipment. And the way I got to know these guys is by utilizing the equipment and by getting to know them. And they said, hey, you know, you know more about this stuff and you're a real big nerd about this stuff. You know, why don't you come work with us? So, you know, anybody that wants to know more about the packaging technology, we can have a conversation about that and be glad to help. And, I also, if you have, some folks that you mentioned the HACCP programs and food safety programs, we touched on that a little bit earlier. If you're a meal prep operator or a restaurant operator and want to understand how to do even modified atmosphere or do tray packaging on a small scale, one of the services that I offer for people that I help with packaging equipment with their packaging is I can provide draft food safety programs for even restaurants. So if you need to have a critical control point program, a GMP program, standard operating procedures, sanitation procedures, I've got all of that lined out in a draft format where, you know, it's not as scary once it's been, you know, put together and vetted, and I can, you know, kind of help people with their food safety plans as well. So.
Love it. Absolutely. Love it. We'll put all this in the show notes. So that way people have links. They can get to everything pretty easy and quickly. Any last closing words before we wrap up?
No, man, I just appreciate you having me. I probably talked your ear off, but you know, I mean, I'm really passionate about this, this sort of thing, you know, about food in general, you know, about the technology of food and about the future of making people, healthier by, you know, by utilizing a better system. So I appreciate you getting the word out.
Yeah. Thanks, Shane, for being on. I know it's been a long time coming. I'm excited we were able to chat. And I know there's probably a lot more conversations in our future as we've been talking. I've got some things rolling around in my head that we can talk about later. So if you want to know what he's doing, again, we'll put everything in the show notes. But until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.